The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to Infinite Positivities. I'm Jenna Ushkowitz. This is a show where I take topics from my book, Choosing Glee, and speak with inspirational people about how to live a positive life. Chapter 16, You Can't Please Everyone. This week, my guest is director, producer, and choreographer Adam Shankman. Adam is best known for his directorial work on films like A Walk to Remember, The Pacifier, and the 2007 remake of Hairspray. He was also a judge on seasons 3 to 10 of So You Think You Can Dance. Working in so many facets of the entertainment industry, Adam knows firsthand the challenges of trying to find the right balance between pleasing audiences and critics while staying true to his creative vision. And I think no matter what you do, that challenge is something we can all relate to. So, before we get to Adam, we're going to hear from journalist and spiritual lifestyle expert Fani Stipkovic on the perils of people-pleasing and why we need to learn how to say no to others and yes to ourselves.
A lot of people are people-pleasers, and they don't even know. If you're motivated in relationships by a sense of guilt, by duty, by obligations, you're a people-pleaser. It's a very, very toxic habit. Why does it happen? Because when people are not connected with themselves, when people don't know themselves well, when people don't invest time into connecting with your inner self, we value other people's opinion more than we value ourselves. And actually, every time when you engage in people-pleasing, you give away a little piece of your self-worth to others to make other people happy. And you know, and then at the end of the day, if you're a people pleaser, your happiness depends on other people, because every time you don't please, you just feel worthless. First, you need to, of course, get an awareness. The most important thing is practice self-acceptance and self-love. Then you have to stop comparing yourself. The only person you should compare yourself is the person that you were yesterday. Then one of the very important things as well, and very important strategies, is start practicing saying no. Because you have to know that saying no doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you a smart person. Give up the need of approval of others. And once you start doing it, you will just start to bring back your self-worth. You will have more confidence, and you will attract better events in your life. Warm hugs to all the listeners of Infinite Positivities here from Dubrovnik, Croatia. Connect with yourself, find your uniqueness, and be proud of that, and live your dream.
I've known Adam Shankman for over 5 years now, between our time on Glee and working on Hair at the Hollywood Bowl. He's a great friend and director, and I recently got a chance to sit down with him in his New York apartment. Hello.
Hello, love.
Thanks for doing this. Aww. Well, first of all, we're in Adam's beautiful New York apartment, which he so graciously lets me stay in when I'm homeless.
Yeah, because I'm worried about you.
Super, it's so beautiful, and it's a beautiful day in New York. It's rainy and gray and disgusting.
Yeah, beautiful. If you're from the fjords,
isn't it nice though to come to New York and have weather at least?
Not only is it great to have weather, but it's incredible to just be in the rain, because it's like a YA novel in LA, right, in terms of the drought. It's like,
I know.
These homes with, that used to have, beautiful lawns and stuff are suddenly now all rocks.
It's like Divergent.
And cactus. Yeah, pretty much. Maze Runner, the last one, the Scorch Trials. That's us.
And by the way, happy birthday. I missed your birthday.
Thank you. It was sort of a non-birthday for me.
What do you mean?
I didn't celebrate. I don't celebrate really my birthday so much anymore. I guess I'm going to hold it off till like the mid-decade and then the decade marks, because like everything in between just feels sort of sad to me as I grow older.
You're getting younger. It's another year younger.
My skin's good.
It is good. You look great.
My skin's good. But other than that,
it's just a year around the sun. It's just a year around the sun.
It is just a year around the sun. Yeah. And by the way, which goes marching across my face year after year after year.
But isn't it also the day after Thanksgiving?
Well, I was born on Thanksgiving. My birthday is the 27th. And so that since that changes every year, what day Thanksgiving is on. So I was born. There is a picture that is very near and dear to my heart of my mother with her water breaking, holding a turkey leg to her mouth.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
You hold that photo close to your heart.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. And I make sure that she gives thanks for my birth every year.
What made you want to get into show business?
I'm probably like you. I don't feel like I picked it. It picked me. And I know that's a dumb thing to say for people who aren't in it. But if you're in it, it's sort of one of those things where, you know, I came out of my mother with a top hat and cane kind of kid, which was pretty annoying, I imagine, for my parents when I was young, because it was all about like showbiz and running around and like musicals. And I was a ham and I wanted attention. And it seemed like the most obvious place for me to go. Although, you know, according to my family and not my mom and dad, but my grandparents and aunts and uncles, they wanted me to, you know, be a doctor or a lawyer or some other nice Jewish thing that I could have been. And that was never what interested me. And sort of creating stories and fantasy and illusion and all of that was it. So anyway, I was obsessed with television when I was a kid, still am. And, I started watching musicals and I was listening to my mom's records and creating plays and performing. So it's sort of like the track never
stopped
really. Right. It was just sort of a train that I got on and I never left. You know, I grew up in the business. My dad's in the business. And so I grew up on the sets of like Mary Tyler Moore and Soap and Love Boat and all these other like TV shows. I went to a lot of movie sets and I was around in the music recording studios a lot. It's not like this stuff wasn't around me in force.
What did your dad do?
He was a lawyer and then a manager and then he produced bunch of TV stuff. And
so they can't really hate you for taking on the
business. No one hated it. There was just a lot of fear around it because no one really discouraged me and my immediate family from doing it, but they certainly knew that it was a harder road that I was pursuing. First, it was just theater, and because that's what I did in school and stuff. Yeah. And my parents were very, very clear that they were not going to let me be like a kid actor, like on TV and stuff. And I knew a lot of kid actors back then. And so they said, you can do whatever you want once you graduate, but you're going to get an education, like a normal school education. And so I auditioned for a bunch of schools and chose Juilliard for dance because I had been working with a choreographer at a theater company that said I was a born dancer and that's what I should be doing. I should be pursuing dance because I can do the rest of it till the end of time.
Right.
But dancing has more of a shelf life. Right. So I decided to pursue that and that brought me to New York and then I dropped out and then I became a chorus boy, which is really all I ever wanted to be. I wanted to be a backup dancer and a chorus boy.
So you started, I mean, I guess because we watched you on So You Think You Can Dance, a lot of it was like, I thought that was your main track, but now and that's not.
I didn't take my first dance class until I was 18, and I just danced in theater productions.
And you got into Juilliard for dance.
It was like
starting
flash dance.
18. Good lord.
Yeah. I took my first dance class at Juilliard, pretty much. So
I mean, for people who don't know, like Juilliard is one of, if not the most prestigious training for a performer in New York.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's great, great schools. The arts departments at, you know, NYU and Columbia and you know, there's all over the place. There's great, great departments, but that's very specifically, it's sort of arts vocational. Mm-hmm. It's very specific. And so if you get into there, it sort of gives you that, you know, that name on your resume that it sort of is like a little gold star.
You dropped out of Juilliard. Was that a hard decision to make?
It
how long did you stay?
I only was there for about a year, but I dropped out because I was so unhappy because, they have a very specific way of teaching and it was, emotionally, it was too hard on me, to be perfectly honest. I didn't have any years of any training and I was sort of treated like I had 15 years of bad training.
Right.
And so my love of what I was doing was beaten out of me, really. And there's too many people who want to do it. There's too much rejection. There's too many talented people out there. It's too emotionally draining on you. And it just erodes at your self-esteem. Even when you're doing well, your right. self-esteem is always at risk because, you know,
you're just on the line all the time.
You're on the line and you don't even really know if you're doing a good job. Sometimes when you're doing a good job, you suspect it. When you're not doing a good job, you really feel it. Mm. And so walking around in your life feeling like you're not good, but you're putting yourself out there a lot, even in moments when you're being praised. And even, you know, like when you were doing Spring Awakening or any of the shows that you did, like you had good shows and you had bad shows.
Right.
And really, those bad shows, like, stick with you.
Yeah,
and
they really do.
And they hang over you like this gray, weird goo.
It just and then when you're having the good day, sometimes it comes back and reminds you. That goo comes back and is like, here I am.
Yeah. I mean, it gnaws at your self-esteem and your feeling of self-worth and are you pulling the wool over people's eyes and are you actually good enough? Right. And how much confirmation do you actually need that you're good versus, you know, it's a complicated thing. And by the way, you feel that as a director, you feel that as a choreographer, or at least I did.
Right.
Well,
yeah. I mean, cause this week, you know, in this chapter, we're talking about, not being able to please everybody. And think for you, especially, it's so important that you have to sort of wash that, you know, keep that idea that you can't please everybody and you have to have enough in your soul to keep going even when shit gets hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's you can't.
It's so true.
You can't. Remember when I kind of came up and when I started doing my jobs, there was also no internet. So there was no, you weren't feeling the pressure of the outside criticism that exists solely for, you know, for anybody who doesn't do this, you can't really explain it because the good comes in dribs and drabs, but the bad is like tidal waves. and you can really, really feel it. I mean, I'll tell you where I can imagine you must have felt it a lot was like, if a plot turned right or left on Glee, one of the storylines or something, the anger that comes from the outside world and the accusations as if you could control it.
Exactly.
It's really, really, really painful. And when I make a movie now, I know that there are going to be people out there in the world putting out statements. Some of them are critics who are paid to do this.
Right.
Who basically call me like the end of cinema or the end of, you know, you are the Jeffrey Dahmer of the Directors Guild. Like you should never be able to do this again. And you are a terrible person and you got get
have
out of it.
Have they said about you in particular?
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Horrible things have been said about me. A lot of the things that I made, a lot of people at the time said really crappy things about, but they ended up doing very, very well. And now people come up to me and tell me how much it touched them or how much their kids enjoyed it or how it brought a family together or any of those things. So it's, you know, you gotta.
Yeah. You take the good with the bad with the good. That's, you know, sort of what I learned about reviews is that, like, if you read the good ones, you have to read the bad ones. Or,
for sure. And so I don't read the good ones either.
Yeah. No.
For whoever is listening out there, when we did Hair at the Hollywood Bowl, that was my first play and that I'd ever directed. And to direct it in front of that many people in such a public way was a little naive of me. Like, I think I was like, this will be great and this will be fun and I understand it and we'll have a great time. And we put all that work into it. We did it in such a compressed period of time. And then it was not only a financial success, which made me very happy for the Hollywood Bowl, but to become the critical success that it was big. And I did read those because there wasn't a lot of them because it was so local.
Yeah. And it was so short. For everybody who doesn't know, for our listeners, Adam Shankman directed Hair, the musical at the Hollywood Bowl, the musical's been revived on Broadway and it was done and there was a movie. And so there's been many, many versions, but he, you know, for some, you know, miracle cast me in it. And it's the Hollywood Bowl. It's one of the most famous, you know, sort of venues
in the world.
In the world, not even in just like the US, in the world. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I can only imagine the pressure of going in, or did you not realize till you were in
I don't
it?
Think I really thought about it until I did it. What I really, you know, it's a public way to come out of the closet, as it were, for me. It was a very, you know, and I love the music, and I understood the comedy of it, and we had a great, great time. And,
you know, I would go home at night and cry over my script, but, you know, other than that, it was good.
Why? Because you had no time?
You think you know all the songs to Hair, like Aquarius and Let the Sun Shine and all these, but there are really, really wordy songs that you sort of skip over and don't realize, and then you're like, oh, I have to know them.
But in terms of talking about, you know, self-worth, that was a risk that I felt like I was taking ultimately, and I'm glad it paid off. And I'm here in New York now, you know, actually bolstering now the potentials for my theater directing. It actually afforded me the opportunity to have something real to talk about. So that was cool.
Yeah, you're a wonderful director, and Ong Lee, and you have a director that comes in, a different director each episode. So it can't be easy for you to come into a well-oiled machine that's kind of chaotic at the same time anyway.
As a director on a TV show, you don't walk in and you're in it with everybody every day. It is not that kind of thing. You're actually stepping into somebody's house. Yeah. You're a guest in somebody else's house. And you are also then tasked with trying to shoot everything, but also not get people upset, you know, and trying to please, you know, the creators of the show and who were taskmasters.
Yeah.
And if you remember, I did the first episode where Ryan wasn't around. Like, he was off promoting...
American Horror Story, probably.
No. Oh, he was off doing his Eat, Pray, Love.
That's right.
And so he was gone for the first time. And
scary.
And no one knew exactly if he was going to approve of anything that was being done. And he created a culture where that was very important to please him.
Right.
And so I was scared. I had directed a lot of movies at that point, and I still walked in and I was scared. He's very exacting in what he wants.
He knows exactly what he wants.
And you know, you are coming in to fit into his vision of a world that he
created.
And Ian and Brad created, and that there was a lot of gotta please daddy going on.
And that's the thing, you know, it's like pleasing those kind of people is part of the job. And then the other side of it is like not, you know, the fans who didn't love the choice that this person made or whatever, you know, it's hard to, you can't please everybody.
No, you definitely can't please everybody. You can't please everybody. And you are, if you go in trying to please it, you're actually going into it with a losing strategy.
Right.
You know, you have to sort of have some peace about that
going in,
which is very, very difficult to find because there's fear around it because you know that there's judgment coming your way.
Right.
So you go in there with that. And then at that point, really all you can do is the best that you can do.
Right.
And you know, sometimes when your head gets knotted up because you become so self-conscious about the choices that you're making, you have to take deep breaths, whatever it is, and go like, okay, this is all problem solving.
Right.
No one's going to die if I get this right.
We're not doing brain surgery here.
No, it's really not.
And then that's also okay to ask for help.
And it is really important to ask for help. I think the most, the real torturous art is painting or, you know, visual arts is sculpting because there really is no one else but you. You're the only one out there doing it.
Yeah, I don't know how people do that.
and it's so subjective.
It's
like you just have to have balls of steel and confidence and going like, I think what I do is good.
I mean, that's sort of, you know, in the realm of what we do as well. It's just like having the vision that you believe in and going for it and, you know, allowing people to help you make that vision as a director, you know, an actor. And
again, when you have those shitty days and you're having a shitty show, how do you make it okay to leave and go to bed and not turn into some crazy monster
in
your head?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Sometimes it's unavoidable, but sometimes there's, you know, ways to just, as an actor, it becomes like a nightmare sometimes that you just learn from it. And you're like, I can't do it again. I just can't go there again.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's going to sound super airy-fairy, but I'm telling you, figuring out a meditation practice is probably the best thing you can do for yourself because finding some way to create quiet in your head is, I think, really, really important just from a health standpoint. Because if you're anything like me, the voices just will go 24/7, and they actually go off most horribly right as I'm going to bed.
I feel like a majority of people, that's sort of when it, the quiet happens and the day stops is when you really hear them. Do you, so you meditate?
I do.
Do you meditate like every single day?
I do. As it turns out, I that didn't start until the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But a few months ago, I filmed a commercial and there's like, again, a totally different kind of skill set because you're answering to advertising people who are, have all sorts of different agendas and in between some shots. And there was a lot of arguing about like wardrobe. I would actually go into another room and I'd put my headphones on and I'd listen to a little 5-minute guided meditation. And I would come back like completely open and ready to work. And I never fought with anybody and I didn't get involved in other people's drama. And
has that shifted because you meditate? Do you find that like it's been a different sort of world for you?
I think there's that. And then I also, this is going to again, this is all going to sound really like, you know, new agey and spiritual, but like I have made it a point every single morning for the last 2.5 years to write out a list of 10 things I am grateful for.
Okay. Well, you know, in my book and in this podcast, we talk about everything is like practicing for me. And that's what you're doing. You're practicing.
I am. I'm gratitude. A participant. I am a participant in my gratitude.
Yeah.
And I make sure that if...
you're not just grateful. You practice it every single day.
Yeah.
That's
and
amazing.
If I do that, no matter how bad a day I know is set up for me... Mm-hmm. Because there's some days that I wake up and I'll look at my schedule and go like, this is not going to be an easy one. But if I start out by writing 10 things that I know I'm grateful for, it actually just resets your mind. And I can go into my day with optimism and a sense of gratitude, even in the worst of circumstances. It doesn't mean that I'm super happy all the time. It doesn't mean that I trust everybody. It doesn't mean all of that. But what I do is it sets me up to know that I'm going for the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm coming from a place of appreciation that can totally dwindle and go out the window during the day because I can't control people. The other thing that I got very, very, very clear about, and this is what made that gratitude possible, was I got very, very clear that I cannot control anything in the world except how I react to things. Now, from we can't please all the people standpoint, when you create something, any kind of an artist, when you create something, you go in hoping for the best. I don't say you're expecting the worst, but you have to, you know, I think having, you know, hoping for the best, and oftentimes you're disappointed, but you've got to figure out how to localize that and go like, okay, how do I push past that?
Right.
And it's not, I am not a serial killer. I an artistic serial killer, right, or a literal or a person serial killer. I
hope not.
I was doing what I did for the reasons that I did them. I'm clear about that. And I do things at this point I try to do them for the right reasons. You know, some things come up, money or, you know, commitments that I've made previously, sure, which I try to honor. And you do it for those reasons. And then you've got to find a way, hell or high water, to move past it into the next.
But it's almost like going into, you know, going into your day with your list and going into a project with that mindset already sets you up for success and for the least amount of in your brain what failure is.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like going in with that, changing that sort of conscious mindset of knowing what's coming and what could come and all the possibilities and being sort of okay with the fact that you can't control it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And no failure feels as grisly as like when you've ultimately really, it's like letting other people down feels terrible. Letting yourself down feels worse to me. Like I was like, I knew this was going to be bad and I did it anyway. No.
Have you ever had projects like that?
Yeah. I don't want to talk about them, but yeah, I've had things that I put out in the world that I was like, that was, I know that I did it for what I thought was the right reason, but the truth is I never believed in it really. And if I get, you know, I cannot blame anybody but myself. I have to take full responsibility. And also accountability in that way helps me because it's the just the truth. Like, I was a big part of this. Mm-hmm. What is the, you know, I can blame everybody if I want, but that doesn't help.
That's them, like, victimizing, or me, and
it doesn't do anything. What part did I take in?
Right. Making that choice.
And making that choice.
Nobody, and then, you know, put a gun to your head and put you at the end of a bridge and said, you have to make this project.
Yeah. And so no matter what the what that decision was based on. So when a bad backlash comes, how I felt about that, because I was like, I deserve this, you know, and then not getting into a whole victimizing, self-pitying place is then the work is going, like, it happened. What do I do now going forward?
Right.
Wallowing is the worst. Like, that's
what's the point?
There's literally no point. It's horrible, horrible. It's eating junk food mixed with rat poison. Do you know what I mean? It's like it somehow feeds you emotionally, and it's terrible for you, and it bloats you, and it sends you into a terrible space, and you're good to no one, and you're not good for
terrible.
Yourself.
That's an amazing mindset, and I think that's exactly what, you know, these listeners want to hear about, and I think that's
good.
Great. So you're a big supporter of the Trevor Project. I wanted to talk about that because you've been so wonderfully involved with them, and just tell sort of the listeners what the Trevor Project is.
The Trevor Project is an organization. It's actually one of the largest suicide and crisis prevention organizations in the world, frankly. Their focus is the LGBTQ community, although kind of one of the unknown facts is about 15% of the calls that we get are from straight kids. Kids who identify as straight, yeah.
Wow.
Because they don't feel like they have anywhere to turn, and we're the most visible online organization, you know, because that's where kids get their information.
That's really
And nice. So it's, we are out there as a helpline and a resource for kids that are in crisis and are seriously considering suicide, are feeling alone, displaced, have nowhere to turn, afraid. And we're helping more kids than ever before. Within the LGBTQ community, what's happened is when you have big strides like marriage equality happening, there's a lot of people who don't want to be told what to accept and believe. And so who is going to pay for that? The kids. Hmm. That's where it gets taken out. So they become more disenfranchised. For people who are non-accepting, they're going to take that out on the weak.
Right.
Basically. So, and the vulnerable. So we are there, and I'm very proud to say in this last event that we just had 2 weeks ago, we raised $1.2 million.
That's amazing.
That's the most we've ever raised in an evening.
Incredible.
And we had some extraordinary honorees, and I, being a little gay kid who was ashamed and didn't know how I felt in the world, I wish I had had as a teenager a resource, someone to talk to, because I developed some lifelong challenges as a result of sort of steeping in that sense of aloneness and pain and all of that. So, and
it was a different world growing up for you.
It was definitely a different world growing up. Yes, World War II is so complicated. It was, again, there was no real internet until I was an adult. And I was also, when I came out, it was like right around the time that it was the beginning of AIDS, the AIDS epidemic. And so then not only was it a shameful culturally to be gay and, you know, really herky wonky, but now suddenly you were going to die from it. And you saw people around you dying from it. And then you had the government and religion coming down going, like, this is what you get for being this.
Mm.
And it was really bad. Mm.
So how important is giving back to you?
It's everything. Now, I think a lot of the is that I'm not going to direct the shows anymore, but I've given them a platform and go with God and do it, and I'm on the board, so I'll be around. But now I kind of want to roll up my sleeves and get in there a little bit more, get into the trenches and deal with the kids a little bit more. because I just relate. I mean, it's so funny. It's like when people responded to me on So You Think You Can Dance, that was, you know, I never had a character on that show. That was just sort of me talking to kids who, as far as I was concerned, kind of looked like I did and wanted the same things I did and
right.
danced better than I did when I was their age, but still were, you know, I knew how to talk to them because I was saying the things that I wish somebody had said to me. Now I feel like I'm in a position to do the exact same thing with identity.
Yeah.
And with Trevor and with also, you know, I've had some great advantages and blessings in my life. Things that have happened, you know, opportunities that I've created, things that I've done, spent time with some pretty extraordinary people. And I get to pass that along, but I can't do it from atop a mountain.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's sort of like, it's for me, it's more interesting to actually have contact with the kids.
Then give your name and, you know, and do the things,
and,
you know, way, directing the shows.
Love raising money. Love giving money. It's all fine. But
that's a big important part of a nonprofit. You know, it's a huge part of it. And to be able
with
to
Dizzy
help.
Feet, with Dizzy Feet, my foundation with Nigel Lithgow, we do the same thing with kids who had, like, I will say this, when I was a kid, there was arts education in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, obviously, there still is in a lot of private schools. But
it's dying. It's dying.
It's decimated. Dead. Yeah. It's and dead. So we charter schools mm-hmm. have some of it, but mostly it's gone. And so we're trying to put that back in communities now, because that saved my life. The arts.
No, I mean it's so important, and it's important for learning. It's not just a recreational thing that kids. You know, it's so important. There's, you know, sciences that are correlated with learning math and listening to music, and it's just I mean, it obviously, you know,
there's a reason
it's close to my heart too.
Arts and sciences,
right.
Right. They are grouped together. They actually have the same effect on the brain and on problem solving and your way to socialize and be and understand the world and feel like you have a place in it and that you are of value. And that's what the arts really taught me.
You're amazing. Thank you.
You're amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me on another episode of Infinite Positivities. Until next time, remember, you can't always please everyone, but you can always stay true to yourself.